Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
All right, welcome back. Second hour of the show for this Thursday afternoon. We, of course, have a Reardon Roundtable ready and raring to go for tomorrow. Jane will be on the panel. St. Louis Automatic President Lewis Reed, State Rep Mary Elizabeth Coleman. She was a newbie a few weeks ago. We like her. We're having her back. That's how it works on the roundtable. So that's tomorrow. Coming up in the next hour, everything you ever wanted to know about stink bugs, but were afraid to ask. These things are all over my house. Dave, do you have them at your house, like on the doors and the screens and stuff like that? Or is it just me?
It's weird that you bring that up, Mark, because actually when I was talking to my in-laws this morning, they mentioned a big problem about stink bugs, and we only live a mile away from them. We've been fortunate that we haven't really had to deal with them that much, but my in-laws really have.
Inundated, Dave. Infestation here at the Reardon household. But I am kind of curious about them, so we're going to talk with Dan Zarlinga from the Conservation Department. Oh, the other thing I want to mention coming up here, well, actually two things this hour. Dr. Rachel Presti, you might have heard about the Eli Lilly study with the antibodies, and she's also conducting research here in WashU. We'll tell you how to take part in that, by the way, in that study. And Jay Richards, this is going to be a good conversation. There's a book coming out next Tuesday called The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. And this is, the topic is lockdowns and how the lockdowns affected the spread of COVID. Jay and two other authors from National Review make the case that not a whole lot. So we'll find out and talk to Jay in just a couple of minutes. So when I woke up this morning, my wife started showing me some videos of some businesses in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Wauwatosa is a suburb of Milwaukee. It was actually the first community that I looked at houses in when I was moving up there in 2006. I ended up in a place called Bayside, which is closer to the lake. But I would compare Wauwatosa a little bit to Webster Kirkwood. The difference would be is that Wauwatosa borders, like directly borders areas of the city of Milwaukee that might not be the nicest neighborhoods. Well, some of this is way back in the memory. So I'm going to bring in Dan O'Donnell, my buddy from WISN. We used to work together at WTMJ. Dan, did I kind of describe that? Because I think it's important that Tosa does sort of border the north part of Milwaukee, which has some areas that are not particularly safe, I would say.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You drive up North Avenue and you go from probably one of the worst areas of Milwaukee to one of the trendiest areas in downtown Wauwatosa.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very unique in that there is a bad neighborhood, and then right across the street is like a thriving commercial district in a different city.
So what? Tell me what happened last night. I remember seeing some on Twitter about some people that were gathering around, I think the police or the courthouse, police station or the courthouse, about another case that you guys have. And, you know, look, we're not hearing about this here in St. Louis, and I think a lot of people across the country didn't even see the videos of what happened. So before we get to the violence and what happened with the protesters, give me a little background on why they were protesting.
Well, this might be one of the most unique officer-involved shootings in the entire country, Mark. Back in February, right before the lockdowns, there was a massive fight at the big mall in southeast Wisconsin, which is located in Wauwatosa. It's called Mayfair Mall. And a police
Mayfair
officer
Mall.
Was just Mayfair Mall. You remember it, I'm sure.
Oh, I remember it well. Saw a lot of movies at Mayfair Mall, yes.
Yeah, it saw a massive fight. And a 17-year-old by the name of Alvin Cole showed up to that fight with a handgun. Then he started screaming, bleep mall security, bleep Wauwatosa police. He's waving the gun around. Police arrive, and one of the officers shoots Cole to death. After Cole fired a shot, he ended up accidentally shooting himself in the arm. And the officer named Joseph Mensa shot and killed Cole. Now, that would be kind of remarkable in and of itself. This happened in a crowded mall parking lot. The same officer, Joseph Mensa, was also involved in the shooting deaths in 2015 and 2016 of two other men, one of whom was black, one was Hispanic. So this was the third deadly shooting that Officer Mensa was responsible for. Mensa himself is also black. This is a situation that didn't really get
so
a lot
I
of
did not yeah. I that that's interesting. I did not know that. I did see that. That was a little fact that eluded me.
And that was something that we in conservative talk radio in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin were trying to tell the masses, because up until we started sounding the alarm, hey, you're inflaming racial tensions by not showing the officer's picture, by not explaining that he's black too. Most people, even in the Milwaukee area, Mark, didn't know that Mensa was black. But this story didn't get any attention outside of even Wauwatosa. I'll admit that I kind of ran across it myself and said, oh, well, that's interesting. And then, of course, on Memorial Day, George Floyd was killed. And then everything sort of went to you know where in Wauwatosa. Jay-Z, his Roc Nation company, weighed in calling for Officer Mensa to be fired. The Jonas Brothers, of all people, weighed in calling for Mensa to be fired. There were community meetings demanding that he be fired. And in fact, in early August, an angry mob showed up at his girlfriend's house in Milwaukee, and they attacked him. They assaulted both Mensa and his girlfriend, and one of the attackers fired a shotgun into the home. So it has been an incredibly violent situation for months now.
All right, now I'm on press for time here, Dan, because I got somebody coming up, and we got to get to that interview. But my understanding is there was a report that was an independent report. I don't know who did the report that recommended that this guy be fired. What can you tell me about that? Yeah. And then I want to hear about the violence, but we got to do it fast. So we got to do a speed round here.
All right, very quickly, the Fire and Police Commission in Wisconsin, the citizen boards in each city, not the police chief or fire chief, are responsible for hiring and firing. Fire and Police Commission wanted him fired, so they had a quote-unquote independent investigation that determined exactly what they wanted the independent investigator to determine.
What about what happened in Tulsa last night? It looked pretty bad. I mean, these are just businesses, and there's a community that I mentioned. It's a lot like Webster Groves or Kirkwood here, and windows being smashed, some of the same stuff we saw in Wauwatosa and here in Ferguson.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think one of the unique things that happened last night is they were targeting residential neighborhoods. They were throwing bricks through people's houses, not just businesses. They were doing donuts on people's front lawns. They were just harassing people in their homes, which was something that I don't think a lot of communities have seen thus far.
So, Dan, let me just ask you briefly here about the COVID situation in Wisconsin, because we saw a couple of reports that and I was describing this before the before the end of the hour, that the fairgrounds there in Milwaukee are very close to the city. It's like an urban state fair. It's very cool, not too far from Miller Park. But is that area, are you guys overwhelmed in Wisconsin right now? Is that the concern, or is this Tony Evers playing games?
This is absolutely him playing games. First of all, the areas where there are hot spots are in Green Bay and La Crosse, which are hundreds of miles away from this hospital. So what, we're gonna hop these patients into ambulances and send them halfway across the state? It doesn't make any sense. And Evers has come under heavy criticism by me, chief among them, who did a daily report on the field hospital that was, you know, purchased with $24 million of taxpayer money but never used. It seems as though he just wants to save face and finally put this thing to use. But the Milwaukee area isn't, and it hasn't been a hot spot since April.
Dan O'Donnell, WISN in Milwaukee. Dude, we're going to have to put you on the payroll. I got to be careful about that, because there's been a lot of, we've tapped into you. But it's great it's great to hook up, and we can bond on this. 4-0 for the Packers. And I'm a Chiefs guy, too, as you know. But 4-0, the pack is looking good. It's so funny, because it doesn't matter who gets injured. You got, you know, wide receiver after wide receiver for Aaron Rodgers, and they keep finding more that he can pass to and score touchdowns. So that's a lot of fun. Dan, you take care. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely, my friend. I'm going to go kill some stink bugs.
Please do it. Take care of those. Yeah, we'll talk about those in the next hour. By the way, I got people texting me stuff about friends, about stink bugs. Okay. All right. Dial back the texting. We're going to find out more in the next hour here on KMOX. Coming up next, we're going to hook up, and this is going to be an interesting topic. Jay Richards, along with a couple other authors at National Review, wrote a book called The Price of Panic. It's out next week, talking about the lockdowns and how much effect, if any, on the spread of COVID.
Miss any part of the Mark Reardon Show? Download the podcast anytime.
Initiating download. Stand by.
At KMOX.com/Reardon.
Coming up 3:30 this afternoon, give you a little detail. This is pretty interesting, the Eli Lilly antibody study that is working, and then some research here at WashU, Dr. Rachel Presti. We'll kind of wind that all in. I think a lot of people have questions about lockdowns, and are they working? How effective are they when it comes to actually reducing the spread of COVID? Conventional wisdom would hold pretty effective. That's what's keeping it in check, except that it's not kept in check all the time. Jay Richards and a couple of folks at National Review have written a book now called The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of the Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. Jay's with me this afternoon for a preview on the Quiver River Electric guest line. Jay, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So let's kind of start with how you did the research to determine that the lockdowns may have had little effect. I think there's a lot of people that would probably agree with that just anecdotally. But how far into the weeds? This is one of those tricky things because I read the piece and there's graphs and things like that. I'm just a dumb guy on the radio, so you got to cull it down for me.
I mean, basically, it's fairly easy, actually, to explain. And so basically, if the government-enforced lockdowns made a difference, then if we're looking at the so-called case curves, so, you know, the kind of curves, the number of people that are getting the sickness and then those that are dying, we should see an effect. So in other words, about 10 days after the government lockdowns went into effect in different states, we should see the curves go down so that there's a lot fewer cases, a lot fewer deaths, because it takes about 10 days between the, you know, incubation stage and time to get tested and everything. And so now we can do that. We know the exact dates when states implemented lockdowns, and we have the case curves. And so you can just map it. And we do that in the piece at National Review. And what you find is that the virus is basically indifferent to the government lockdowns. If we didn't tell you when the government lockdowns in these different states happened, there's no way you could ever figure it out from looking at the curves. And the best way to interpret that is that basically the government lockdowns just didn't seem to make any difference one way or the other.
So where did you look for the info? You know, in Missouri, for example, we didn't have a lockdown. We did here where I am in St. Louis County. But sometimes, you know, it's almost like a different planet if you cross counties here in Missouri. And, you know, I think Illinois has had some of this, although they've had more stringent lockdowns from their governor. So what states did you take a look at here?
We looked at all of them, actually. And so this analysis that we talk about in the National Review piece was actually just at the level of states, which is really the easiest thing to do, because, as you know, there were sort of local variations. But what we have is fixed dates for individual states. And then, fortunately, we have the benefit of hindsight, because, of course, at the time, if people were looking at Worldometer and different websites that are trying to track this stuff in real time, you can't really do that. The good news is you wait about 6 weeks, and the CDC manages to work out the numbers. And so that's what we do in the book, is we get the latest data a few weeks out, and we basically pointing to the numbers at the CDC. So this isn't stuff we made up in our heads. We're actually using the official numbers.
So let's look, and I know you mentioned in the piece, you mentioned California, but let's look at California, because they were, you know, pretty early in, Gavin Newsom was on the lockdowns. And then there was a little, I think, yes, if I remember, there was a little relaxation, you know, at the end of May, and then all of a sudden was locked down again. So they've had about 16,000 deaths related to COVID, 411 per population, 15 million tests. Oh, you can go on and on and on. But the argument would be then you're saying, based on your evidence, if California did not lock down in the way that they did with, you know, in Los Angeles in particular, I think they were concerned about cases, or San Francisco was certainly one of the hot spots, that they would not have had, you could make a case that they would not have had that many deaths, or the number of deaths would have been the same.
Probably roughly the same. I mean, the reality is there's obviously local variation. I mean, that's true with different countries. You've got countries like South Korea and Vietnam that had very few cases and very few deaths. We suspect that there's a sort of a combination of population density and weather that really made the most difference, and also voluntary social distancing. We think the evidence is really suggests that what we do naturally, we sort of calculate our own risk when we get the information. That made about all the difference that was going to be made, and all the really the government shutdowns did is that they threw people out of schools, they threw them into houses, and they not only didn't make any difference, they may actually have had knock-on costs. That, in other words, the cost is much greater than the effect. That's the really sad thing. And honestly, nobody wants to talk about this because we don't want to think that all this pain that we went through, most of it actually was not only not necessary, but it didn't do any good. But if we're going to avoid making the same mistake again, I think we need to have this conversation.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that, and I'm very concerned and have been, and I think there's a lot of people out there about the long-term consequences of many of these things, economically, mentally, and beyond. I mean, I taught kindergarten until last Wednesday in my home, so I was certainly into the virtual schooling, have concern about kids. But how do we get to a point where, Jay, where we can have that conversation? Because, look, I do a talk show. It's a talk show with an opinion. I'm actually paid to have an opinion. I have a perspective on things. But we know what's happened with the regular media, and this doesn't fit the COVID narrative, right? So that doesn't fit the narrative. So how do you get people to discuss this that should be discussing it?
I mean, honestly, it's a little bit of what we're doing right now. The reality is there's been just a massive media onslaught in favor of the panic porn. But I do think about half the population is now ready to hear the arguments. The good news is the CDC numbers are on our side on this. The original projections of 3.5% infection fatality rate, totally wrong. It's way less than 0.5%. We know this now from the actual numbers. So we've got the evidence and the science on our side. It's just a matter of kind of pushing through the mainstream media narrative, unfortunately.
Jay Richards with me. There's a new book that's going to be out by the authors of this piece called The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. What do you focus in on there when it comes to the price that we're going to pay long term? Obviously, economically, I've pointed toward commercial real estate, for example. I mean, that market's probably going to collapse, and that might be one big effect. What else do you guys get into here when it comes to the price?
A loss of life. I mean, the reality is we can talk about economic cost, and we calculate it's about $1 trillion per month for the lockdowns. But it's not money that's the point. Those are human lives. Those are jobs. That's health. That's all the cases of cancer that don't get screened that people end up dying from. It's all the kind of psychological effects. It's cardiovascular disease that doesn't get screened. The reality is that the lockdowns will probably in the end have cost more lives than we actually lost to COVID-19. That's honestly the most depressing outcome of the research in our book.
Jay, let me get your response to what Dr. Fauci says. And look, I think there are a lot of people concerned moving forward about, you know, getting rid of the lockdowns and having normalization. Okay. But the reality is this thing still is real. It's infectious and it does kill a lot of people. So let me hear. I want your reaction to what Dr. Fauci says as we enter into the cold weather, because it's a little different. And I don't know if the research accounts for this, but when you're talking about lockdowns in the spring, obviously there's a lot of opportunity to do things outdoors. I don't know if that matters or not, but here's what Dr. Fauci said. Here we go.
The models tell us that if we do not do the kinds of things that we're talking about in the cold of the fall and the winter, we could have from 300,000 to 400,000 deaths. That would be just so tragic if that happens.
What's your reaction to that then? Because, you know, if this thing is airborne and people are indoors, that's obviously the concern.
No, that's right. But notice what Dr. Fauci said. He said the models predict. This isn't data. This is based on speculative models, and models only tell you what you tell them to say. I can't believe that he's still so gullible as to believe this is what we did in March. The reason we had the lockdowns is because models that assumed lockdowns would work, right? And so we locked everything down. Turns out we learned very quickly the models were no more valuable than a cracked crystal ball. And he's still doing it. This isn't based on the data on infection fatality rates. It's based once again on these speculative models. Our argument in the book is let's actually focus on the evidence and forget these predictive models that can ultimately only tell you what you've put into them.
Do you agree or disagree that some governors, for example, our governor, Mike Parson, and he's come under a lot of criticism, have looked at these issues, and that's how they've made some of their decisions?
That's exactly what's happened. I don't know so much about Missouri. I know a heck of a lot about Florida. And governors, fortunately, they're heads of state, and they can look at the evidence just as well as the president can. We've been assuming that, you know, the two or three public health officials that President Trump, for instance, happened to inherit in the federal government are somehow the smartest people in the room. Well, they're not. They're smart people at Harvard and Oxford and Stanford that will tell you and are telling us this is not what we should be doing. Let's forgive politicians for maybe believing their advice and their advisors in March, but we do not want to do lockdowns for the whole population again. Let's focus on those people that are at really high risk, and then let the rest of us that are at very, very low risk get back to normal life.
Jay, I think you're right about this, and I just have this terrible feeling, though, that we're heading in the opposite direction, and people are not going to listen to information like this. The book, though, is out next week, The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. Doug Axe, William Briggs, and Jay Richards. Jay, thank you so much for coming on this afternoon. Keep on them, okay?
My pleasure. Sure will.
News Radio 1120 KMOX. The voice of the Cardinals.
Audio cut of the day before the end of this hour. So some good news, and we don't get a lot of that when it comes to COVID. Eli Lilly is lauding its new antibody treatment. There's some of that going on, some research here in St. Louis as well. So I'd like to get some reaction from Dr. Rachel Presti, who's an associate professor of medicine at Washington University School of Medicine and the director of the school's infectious diseases clinical research group. She joins me on the Quiver River Electric guest line. Dr. Presti, how are you?
I'm good today. How are you?
Good. So how encouraging is the Eli Lilly antibody treatment to someone like you who works on these things?
Well, I think we've been excited about the possibility of having specific monoclonal antibodies for a while. You know, we've used antibody therapy for, you know, 100 years in infectious diseases. And, you know, we had done work with the convalescent plasma, but then each dose of convalescent plasma depends on the donor and can be variable. And, you know, it's really a little unclear how well that was working. And so it's really exciting to have, you know, a synthetic specific antibody against SARS-CoV-2 that we can use as a therapeutic. I think we're still not totally sure exactly how well it works, but the initial data looks promising.
When you say as a therapeutic, this means like if someone is, I guess, contagious with COVID or test positive for COVID, at that point, that's when you use it?
Well, actually, I think we're testing a whole variety of ways to use it. So, and it may be that the earlier you use it, the better. So, so right now, we are doing studies at WashU and around the country. There are studies being done looking at, can you use these monoclonal antibody therapies? So like the Lilly one, like the Regeneron one, and there's tons of other companies looking at doing this as well. Can you use those in people who just have been exposed? So they're living with someone who's been infected. If you gave them the antibody, would that prevent them from getting sick? And then for the person who's infected, if you can give them antibodies early in the infection before their body starts to develop its own antibodies, you might be able to decrease the amount of virus and help them get better. And then for people who are actually getting really sick and in the hospital, we're also giving or trying to see if it works to give people antibody therapy to see if those antibodies work better, you know, if their own immune system is just not fighting off the virus very well.
Absolutely. And that's a good explanation. On the Eli Lilly stuff, I mean, what's the reality of actually having this, you know, in vials and doses that can be distributed? Because the numbers that I heard yesterday still, you know, pales in comparison to what we really need. I think they're only talking about 1 million doses or something at this point, right?
Right. Well, you know, that's sort of the one downfall to the monoclonal antibodies. They're not the easiest thing to make in the lab. And so it's hard to scale up and make a ton of them. And so I think we're going to need to think about where are the most useful places to use them. You know, who are the people that are going to benefit the most? You know, it's great to give it to household contacts, but it may be that if you give it to people early in infection, you know, that you get, you know, you help them and you prevent them from infecting more people. And, you know, and we do want to have them available if we've got people in the hospital who are sick and aren't making a good antibody response yet.
By the way, on your local research here, are you still looking for people to volunteer and take part in that research?
We are, yes. So all of those studies are still open, and we're still looking for people who are interested in participating.
I don't know if this is your area of expertise. Let me ask this question. I just thought of it when you were talking about, you know, the uninfected family members of people with COVID. But I've heard so many accounts from people who have had families and friends, and, you know, the infection has spread. But I've heard multiple accounts of, like, a person driving in a car across the country with someone who has COVID. That person didn't get it. Living in the same house with someone who had COVID, that person doesn't get it. Or maybe they're completely asymptomatic. We don't know. But what is there any theory on that? Because that's not, in my opinion, I've heard enough stories where it's not just completely isolated.
Right. No, I mean, I think it's definitely not 100% kind of thing. And I think we still don't know why some people get it and some people don't. And we still don't know exactly why, you know, we get these super spreader events sometimes. But then there are other times where people don't seem to be infected. So there was a really nicely detailed study that came out of Germany looking at a family, and one of the family members got infected and decided, you know what, we should just get this all over with, sort of like those chicken pox parties that people right. used to have back in the day. You know, let's just not try to prevent this. Let's just let everybody get sick. And the thing that was odd is even they knew they were doing this, and they actually studied it, and they sampled all the family members, and not everybody got sick. So some of that may be that some people actually have some sort of innate resistance. Some of it might be the amount of virus that the index person who's infected is shedding and how mm-hmm. infectious they are. You know, we know that some people seem to be very infectious actually even before they're symptomatic. And once they start having symptoms, they may just not be quite as infectious anymore. You know, maybe the symptoms are partly because your immune system is actually fighting back the virus, and so, you know, so how infectious it is, and how it spreads, we're still trying to figure all of that out, and why it does happen sometimes that you think this person should definitely have gotten infected. They were. Like you said,
yeah, it's crazy. Right. There's so much stuff that gets out there. Wasn't there a vitamin D component in some of this as well?
It's possible.
Words,
you know, vitamin D is a little complicated in that, you know, we've looked at vitamin D for lots and lots and lots of infections. And so if you look at people's vitamin D levels, it does seem to correlate with people having more severe disease sometimes. But there are lots of confounders to that, because having low vitamin D also probably means that your diet is not quite as good. It might, you know, it could be that you're not out in the sun as much. Oftentimes people who have darker skin actually have lower levels of vitamin D. So there's lots of other confounders that are associated with vitamin D. And the problem is that in other infectious diseases like TB, and like the common cold, when people have looked at giving supplemental vitamin D, it doesn't always work. So it's a correlation sometimes with more severe respiratory illness. But we just don't know yet if that would help.
Yeah, got it. This is great information. I love it. Dr. Rachel Presti, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Good stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Here's, by the way, in case you want to take part in that research that Dr. Presti is doing, you can call this number. It's the Washington University study, 314-454-0058, 314-454-0058. By the way, the vitamin D stuff is kind of fascinating to me, because I ran across, I've talked about this on the air just a little bit. I think I tried to get a guest at one point, but there was a great research article I ran across maybe even a year and a half ago about how, you know, we always think we're doing the right thing, and maybe this is what's happening with COVID, but we've worn sunscreen for many, many decades now and emphasized how dangerous the sun is. Although it does provide vitamin D, we've deprived ourselves of vitamin D, which we need. So there's a little give and take with a lot of this stuff, and I think a lot of people don't recognize that. 344 at KMOX. We have an audio cut of the day. I got a bunch of things I kind of want to round up, and then we'll settle on one cut of the day. Governor Parson has chimed in on a mask mandate for Missouri, and the answer that he gave about why he wouldn't do it is sort of interesting. So that's coming up here in just a couple of minutes. I love you more than a California sunset. Well, this is, and I like country music quite a bit. You know, I was telling someone this story. Oh, Mark Cantor, my friend Mark Cantor, Cantor and Jula. 30 years ago, you had never caught me listening to a country song, but I like a lot of country music these days. I like a lot of different music. So I'm not quite as narrow-minded when it comes to music as I was when I was younger. But Morgan Wall, I like some of his songs. So he was supposed to perform on SNL this weekend. But when I saw this morning, I thought, and I was going to rip on SNL. I thought, come on, man, because he was caught in some videos with no masks, right? Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Let's hear what he had to say. What happened was he was caught on video on TikTok, and he was making out with chicks and sticking his hand up their skirts and stuff like that. So here's what he said. He says he understands. He apologizes.
I'm in New York City in a hotel room. I was getting ready for SNL this Saturday, and I got a call from the show letting me know that I will no longer be able to play. And that's because of COVID protocols, which I understand. I'm not positive for COVID, but my actions this past weekend were pretty short-sighted, and they have obviously affected my long-term goals and my dreams. I respect the show's decision because I know that I put them in jeopardy, and I take ownership for this. I'd like to apologize to SNL, to my fans, to my team for bringing me these opportunities, and I let them down.
You know, I would love to rip on SNL, but I'm actually going to say two nice things about SNL. First, they had no choice. If you would see these videos, they had no choice in this situation. You can't risk spreading whatever to, you know, it would be terrible. So Lorne Michaels had to make that call. Now, he told Morgan Wallen, look, dude, you're going to come back. We'll make up for it. And I think that's a good thing. And I think he's handling it well. However, let me say this. This is pretty exciting. And I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. But the host of SNL this weekend is one of the best stand-up comedians on the planet right now, Mr. Bill Burr. Hockey fan, healthy respect, even though he's a Bruins fan for the St. Louis Blues. He's been a guest on this show. Bill Burr is not about the cancel culture. Bill Burr is not about PC nonsense. Bill Burr is funny, and he tells it like it is. And I can't wait to see that, because I'll be very interested to see if he's drawn into just ripping Trump, because that's not what he does. So real, real interesting developments there from Saturday Night Live. I don't think they announced who's going to replace Morgan Wallen. It's there was one person who follows me on Twitter, and they said Ashley McBride. Ashley McBride would be a great choice, up-and-coming country star. Dave, I'm going to call an audible here on the audio cut of the day. We'll do an audio daily double, but let's use the governor first, because this is sort of new audio this afternoon from Governor Parson. So let's roll audio cut of the day.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Cut of the day this afternoon is sponsored by the Good Feet Store, pain relief and comfort to fit any budget. I think we hear Kevin Colleen asking a question here to Governor Parson.
If you want to talk about mask mandates by the governor or one individual.
Hang on. I don't think that he's there. Hold on. So this question, maybe there is Kevin's voice in here, but the question is a mask mandate and whether or not there'd be a mask mandate potentially in Missouri.
If you want to talk about mask mandates by the governor or one individual person, let me tell you why I believe that you have to be very careful as governor when you do things like that. There's a vaccine that'll be out in 2 or 3 months, probably. So do we want one person in the state to be able to tell every man, woman, and child that they're going to have a vaccine? That's the road we're going down. That's why it's important for me, for the mayors, the county executives, the county commissioners, to get the public input to see what their districts want to do. I don't ever want to be able to be in a situation where I could use the power of the governor to do things like that. I recommend wearing a mask from day one, continue to do that, but I'm confident the leaders in this state can make the right decisions for their people.
Well, it sounded like the governor made sense there, but he'll just be labeled as an anti-mask person. And then, because I'm going to make this an audio daily double for audio cut of the day, that damn fly flying around. It's been flying around ever since last night. It's been in my office, too, after leaving Mike Pence's head. My dad texts me. He says it's a drone that was trying to capture information. It's 3:56. That's your audio cut of the day.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.